Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. With just days before the midterm election, voters are having problems with electronic voting machines in Texas, Georgia, and Indiana. We've been reporting on the vulnerability of these hackable machines for many years. In a recent New York Times Magazine piece called The Crisis of Election Security, today's guest, independent journalist Kim Zetter, asks, how did our election system get so vulnerable, and why haven't officials tried harder to fix it? The answer ultimately comes down to politics and money. The voting machines are made by well-connected private companies that wield immense control over their proprietary software, often fighting vigorously in court to prevent anyone from examining it when things go awry. In fact, this happened to John Kerry in Ohio in 2004, and we'll talk with Kim about what John Kerry told WNYC's Brian Lehrer. Kim Zetter is an award-winning investigative journalist who's been covering privacy, computer security, and national security for more than a decade. She is author of the book Countdown to Zero Day, which tells the story of a virus and a worm created by the U.S. and Israel to sabotage Iran's nuclear weapon. Hi, Kim. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for bringing me back.
Well, it's great to have you, and thank you for this, well, pretty scary and infuriating piece, which we'll dive into in a minute. But I want to ask you, in the last couple of weeks, we have reported on voting machine problems in Texas, Georgia, and a listener told us about problems in Indiana a couple of days ago. I believe it was his sister who was having problems. Are you hearing about voting machine problems in any other parts of the country?
So there are always problems with machines not working, breaking down, or what voters call vote flipping, but it's actually quite often a calibration issue. So in parts of Georgia, we're seeing long lines because machines aren't starting up or they're being taken out of service, things like that. So that's not unusual. It happens in every election.
That's not unusual. I mean, these are big problems. I don't mean to laugh, but it's just, you know, why are these machines still in use? As you report in this piece, it's all about politics and money. These voting machines are made by well-connected private companies.
Yeah, I don't mean to make light of the issue in saying that it happens in every election. You're absolutely right to ask the question of why does it keep happening, particularly because when the machines malfunction or they get taken out of service, it means longer lines for voters. And, of course, longer lines for voters potentially means that the voters will be disenfranchised. They can't wait around for hours to get to work or to get home and pick up kids and things like that, and so they're more likely to leave the polls. So the machines, they're decade old, and this is largely because counties and states don't have money to replace machines. This is really expensive equipment. And so the machines were purchased, many of them between 2002 and 2006, using money that was provided by the federal government. And in the absence of the federal government providing more funds to buy new machines at this point, states and counties are pretty much stuck with those machines unless they can come up with the money of their own. But I should point out, though, that any new machines that they would buy, any, let's say, you know, brand new hardware equipment, will still be old equipment in the sense that it's old designed equipment. And any equipment that's on the market that can be purchased today as presumably new equipment was certified to standards a decade ago, so 2007. And that's really ancient in the computer world.
Kim, given that you recently wrote this 15-page piece for the New York Times Magazine and you have written extensively about these issues, do you believe that every vote will be counted on Tuesday?
That's an unfair question. Let me say this. So everyone is worried about hacking, right? Everyone is worried about interference from Russian nation state hackers or someone else wanting to intentionally interfere with the vote. But there's just another problem that's just as insidious as that, and that's software glitches. And those don't get quite as much notice, but it happens almost in every election that something goes wrong with software that prevents votes from being recorded, or it loses recorded votes, or alters the tally in some way. And so if you ask me a broad question about whether or not I think every vote will get counted, no, no vote ever. It's not the case in any election that every vote always gets counted.
Well, what would you say to people who are so cynical about this? I mean, the system in general, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and then electronic voting machines. Because a lot of people, as you know, say that this is totally rigged because these machines can be hacked. And now that, you know, the votes are being switched in Texas, long, long lines in Georgia, Indiana's having problems. What would you say to people who just don't believe in this system and say these machines are there to steal elections?
Well, okay. So in terms of, I need to sort of walk you back a little because vote switching in Texas, as far as Texas has concluded there, it's not the machines that are switching the votes, okay? They diagnosed an issue where the voter is touching the machine while it's still rendering the ballot, and that's causing them to deselect votes that are already made by the machine. So there is a usability issue, but it's not the machine is switching the votes. The voter is taking an action that the machine should be preventing them from doing at that point and is not. So it's a design flaw there. In terms of rigging the election, so we have no evidence that any machine has been rigged for an election. That I say with the caveat that no one has actually ever looked for evidence to see if machines have been rigged. So I think that, you know, we have to be careful about sort of addressing the concerns of voters. They're valid concerns that the potential security issues are there. I don't think that it should stop voters from voting. You can vote remotely. You can, in many states, you can request an absentee ballot that will produce a paper record of your vote. And you can also, vote on optical scan machines in many counties, and that produces a paper record. What voters should be doing is demanding from their election officials that they, in places where they don't have paper ballots, they should switch to paper ballots, and that the counties and states conduct mandatory audits, a physical examination of those paper ballots after every election to compare them against the digital tally to make sure that the digital tally is correct. But voters absolutely should not stay away from the polls because the systems have the potential to be subverted.
Well, as Carol Anderson says, who was on our show the other day talking about voter suppression, the only way to really beat all of this, the voter suppression, the gerrymandering, the machines, is to vote in massive, massive numbers. But I have to ask you about the rigging, because as you know, this gets talked about a lot during election time. And it's really frustrating because we have been having these conversations for years. What has really changed since the 2000 election? Have things gotten any better, worse, or are they the same?
Since the 2000 election or the 2016?
2000.
Oh.
Way back when we had the hanging chads.
Yeah. So between 2000 and 2016, little changed in terms of the integrity of elections. So we did, what we got were these machines that can be hacked. So that's sort of a major step back from 2000. What we did, though, get beginning around 2004, 2006, where a handful of states started to switch from paperless voting machines to machines that have an optical scan paper ballot. So we've seen progress in that regard, but as I point out, most states, even if they have the paper, they never look at it, so it doesn't do any good to have the paper trail if you don't actually do an audit. Now, what we've seen since 2016, though, of course, is massive awareness about the security issues in a way that we've never seen before. Election integrity activists have been trying to hammer this home for a decade and have been largely ignored, criticized, denigrated by election officials and the voting machine vendors. And after 2016, let's give a shout out to the Russians, I guess, a thank you to them for drawing attention to the problems and getting the federal government involved through the Department of Homeland Security. And a lot of pressure on states and vendors now to get security right.
Machines that are not connected to the internet can also be hacked. You write that the fact that many voting machines that election officials insist are disconnected from the internet and therefore beyond the reach of hackers are in fact accessible by way of the modem they use to transmit vote totals on election night. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so many machines, including the optical scan machines, have embedded cellular modems in them. And what that means is at the end of the election, when they close down, the poll worker will then instruct the machine to dial up via the modem to the Central Elections Office. So it goes to a cell phone tower. The problem with that is that a cell phone tower can be, let's say, emulated. There are devices called stingrays. If you're in the vicinity of a polling place or an elections office, you can set up a stingray that will trick a device into attaching to it instead of a legitimate cell tower. And once you have the voting machine attached to your Renegade device, you can potentially alter votes as they're transmitted to the elections office. But those are unofficial votes. The official tally will come in later. But nonetheless, if you can alter that unofficial tally and it differs significantly from the official tally tabulated days later, that can create a lot of mistrust for voters who think which tally is actually correct. Worse than that, though, is that once you're able to get a voting machine to connect to your Renegade device, that gives you an open communication channel to then possibly dig back into that voting machine and alter the software or alter the actual official votes that are stored on that machine.
So do we know how, if this has happened before?
We don't know if it's happened before. The modems have been used for years. We don't know the security that vendors are using around them. The vendors tell us that they secure that communication channel, but they don't provide any evidence of doing that. And I should point out also that although the voting machines themselves undergo testing in a lab, in a certification process, the modems that are used for the voting machines do not undergo any testing at all, and the method for using the modems does not undergo testing. So there's no independent party that's actually examining the use of the modems to determine whether or not they're being used securely.
And do you think that we need an independent party to monitor all of this? What would that look like exactly?
Well, we have right now the way that it works now is that when a voting machine vendor produces a voting machine, they submit it to the what's called the it's a voting machine testing lab, and it's an independent lab. The voting machine vendor pays for the testing, and the Election Assistance Commission, a federal body, sort of oversees the process, but only in regards to making sure that the reports that arrive from the lab are then posted online for election officials who want to purchase these machines to read and see. So we have sort of basic oversight of the testing and certification process, but it's not a robust process. And you can look at the state of the machines that we have in the field today as proof that that process is broken.
If someone goes to vote on Tuesday and they have to vote on a machine, I mean, every state and every county has different rules, but can they ask for a paper ballot instead of using the machine?
There are some jurisdictions that have that do allow voters to vote on a paper ballot. It's a provisional ballot. Provisional ballots are generally used for voters who don't show up on the voter roll for one reason or another. They're at the wrong they're at the wrong precinct, or there's something wrong with their voter registration or something, and they're given the paper ballot at the provisional ballot. In that case, election officials will check and verify that their registration is valid before that vote gets counted. There aren't a lot of counties and states that will just allow you to sort of randomly demand a paper ballot, but many places, as I point out, allow you to do absentee voting. So voters should absolutely, if they have concerns about voting machines, request an absentee ballot. Generally, there's a deadline for doing that. But you can bring that into your polling place on election day and hand it in there, or you can take it into the county election offices, or you can mail it in.
Today we're speaking with Kim Zetter. She's an independent journalist. She recently wrote a lengthy piece in the New York Times Magazine called The Crisis of Election Security. If you have any questions for Kim about electronic machines, We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What do you use in your area? As Kim reports, 350,000 voting machines are in use across the country today, all of which fall into one of two categories, optical scan machines or direct recording electronic machines. And each of these suffers from significant security problems. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So first, let's talk about the vendors, and let's talk about the election officials who are supposed to oversee these machines. So there are 350,000 voting machines in use in the country, and you report that these machines are made by well-connected private companies that wield immense control over their proprietary software. How many companies are we talking about?
Today we're talking primarily two companies. So when these machines were first being purchased by states and counties, there were four primary companies: Election Systems and Software, a company at the time that was called Diebold Election Systems, a company called Sequoia Voting Systems, and Hart InterCivic. since that period, 2006 or so, two of those voting machine companies have gone out of business. Diebold got out of the election business in 2009 and sold its assets and its customer contracts to ESNS and to a fifth voting machine vendor out of Canada called Dominion. So Sequoia also went out of business and sold its equipment and contracts to Dominion as well. So two voting machine vendors, Sequoia and Dominion, have now been sort of consolidated. Diebold and Sequoia have now been consolidated into Dominion. And so that means that Dominion and ESNS are the two top voting machine vendors in the country. Their machines count about 80% of the ballots, the votes.
And how much money are we talking about? What are the profits for these voting machine companies?
Well, many of the profits were made in the initial period of the purchase of the machines in around 2006. The voting machine industry is about a $300 million industry annually. That's actually really small if you're talking about really large corporations. So it's actually a tiny industry. And once the machines are purchased, there aren't a lot of follow-up sales because the machines, as you point out, are used for a decade. So there aren't a lot of additional sales of equipment. Where the voting machine vendors make their money after the initial sales of equipment is is in the maintenance contracts, and those can be quite lucrative.
And what is the relationship like between the voting companies and politicians?
Well, in the early days, two of the top voting machine makers, let's start with Election Systems and Software. Election Systems and Software, the head of the company at one time, when it went under a different name, was Chuck Hagel, mm-hmm. who was a politician at the time and had resigned his position in the company just weeks before he announced his campaign for the Senate. So he was based in Nebraska, and Election Systems and Software is based in Nebraska. And so his former company essentially counted the majority of the ballots that were used to elect him to the Senate. Later after that, almost a decade after that, when Diebold Election Systems got into the elections business, Diebold is a security company that makes ATMs and safes for banks and things like that. They bought into the election business in 2001 by purchasing another election company. So they didn't actually make the machines themselves, but they bought into the business. And, of course, we all probably are familiar with, in 2003, the CEO of Diebold made an announcement. He was a top fundraiser for George Bush's presidential campaign, and he sent a letter to fundraisers saying that he and his company were looking forward to delivering the votes to George Bush in the 2004 presidential election. Of course, that caused a huge uproar. And also, Diebold had been shown to be contributing to the Republican campaigns. So there has been focus on the voting machine vendors and their connections to the Republican Party, but that's just at the federal level. There's still a lot of sort of lobbying that goes on between the voting machine vendors at the state level.
And the state level with, is it just Republicans or is it both Republicans and Democrats? Do you know?
We see primarily Republicans, and we see donations to Republican candidates who are in the positions to make decisions about voting machines, about laws over elections and voting machines, and then just Republican candidates in general.
Kim Zetter is an award-winning investigative journalist who has been covering privacy, computer security, and national security for more than a decade. You can read her piece in the New York Times Magazine, The Crisis of Election Security, at yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about the proprietary software. As you point out, the voting machines are made by these well-connected private companies, and they wield immense control over their proprietary software, and they fight in court to prevent anyone from examining it when things don't work out, when things go awry. In Ohio in 2004, where John Kerry lost the presidential race following so many election irregularities, his team was denied access to the voting machine software. He recently told WNYC's Brian Lehrer, quote, "We were told by the court that you were not able to get that algorithm to check it because it was proprietary information." And then he said how wrong it was that elections are held under the, quote, "purview of privately owned machines where the public doesn't have the right to know whether the algorithm has been checked or whether they're hackable or not. And we now know they are hackable." Have you heard John Kerry talk about this before?
No, that was the first time, and you know, he was talking in relation to a book that he had published, and I looked through the book to see if there was any mention of this, and the book doesn't discuss it at all. So we don't. I tried to reach out to Kerry and his publicity people at the publisher, and no one responded because I wanted to get a few more details about this. It's unclear whether or not they were seeking to look at the software before the election, because of course there were concerns going into the election that there were going to be problems with the voting machines, or whether they did it post-election. I believe it may have been before the actual election. It's unclear, though.
Wow. Because books have been written about what happened in 2004. We did so many shows about Ohio 2004. And you just have to wonder if John Kerry, you know, he didn't have access, his team, to the proprietary software, and he says we now know these machines are hackable. Why isn't he or other Democrats screaming about these machines, saying we need to go back to paper ballots?
I think there are a lot of politics around this. People always say that the lawmakers don't care about this because it would be questioning the machines that got them into office. And no one wants to draw attention to machines. It's sort of the same thing that we're seeing now with Trump, right? And the resistance there to talking about election interference. You don't want to draw attention to something that may call into question your legitimacy in office. But I don't think that that's the main reason that lawmakers have sort of ignored this issue. I think that there's been a lot of lobbying on the part of voting machine vendors and a lot of resistance on the part of election officials. If election officials themselves were concerned about the security of the voting machines, they would have been pressuring lawmakers to demand more oversight over voting machine vendors, and they haven't. And in fact, they've embraced the machines and have been in opposition to people over the years who have tried to point out problems with the machines. So I think that, you know, lawmakers respond when there's an outcry to respond, and because the only voices that they seemed to hear were from the people who felt like the machines were okay, they did nothing.
Kim Zetter is an award-winning investigative journalist who has been covering privacy, computer security, and national security for more than a decade. She's got a lengthy piece in last month's New York Times Magazine called The Crisis of Election Security. As the midterms approach, America's electronic voting machines are more vulnerable than ever. Why isn't anyone trying to fix them? This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you're involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington. More on the war in Yemen, leadership changes in Germany and Brazil, and the recent protest at Google. That and more, 1A at 11, here on KLW. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it's our media roundtable. And coming up in just a bit, we will speak with Will Carlos, a correspondent for Reveal. We will speak to him about Brazil's new president, Jair Bolsonaro, and the country's radical shift to the right. We will talk about what the mood is like on the ground now that it's been about a week since the election. Joining us now is Kim Zetter, an award-winning investigative journalist who covers privacy, computer security, and national security. She has a piece out in the New York Times Magazine called The Crisis of Election Security. If you have friends in Texas, Georgia, and Indiana, be sure to tell them about the problems that they're experiencing with voting machines. Find articles online and let them know what's going on. It's so important to get the word out about this. And if you have any questions for Kim about electronic voting machines, what are your thoughts about media coverage of this? This is something that we've been covering for so long, and I feel like we just keep having the same conversation. 866-798-8255. Although there does seem to be more awareness now and more media coverage. And I'll ask him about that in a few minutes. But first, let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I had a general comment and a specific question. My general comment is that I think, vis-a-vis the media coverage, that there's been way too much of a focus on Russian interference and Russian hacking with our elections, which I believe is minimal compared, not much of a mention on how much the different parties, as in Republican and Democrat, are doing to sabotage the election system. Specifically, I would point to Greg Palast's book and documentary film, Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I think the bigger danger is folks like Kobach in Kansas and Evan Kemp, who is the attorney general and who's also running for a position as either congressperson or senator. That was a comment, and I'd like response. And the other is a question, which is about my voting machines in El Cerrito. And this, I don't know if this is a problem. Tabulate it electronically, and then it prints out, and then they give me the ballot, and then they just say, is this what you want to be counted? And I don't know if there are any hiccups that can happen with that.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. Do you know, Kim?
Am I responding to her initial comment?
Why don't you take her second question about her what she votes on?
So I don't know what it is she's voting on, but you never actually are given the ballot.
Right.
So that's confusing to me. There are two kinds of machines, as you point out. There's the optical scan machine, and then there's the direct recording electronic machine. As far as I know, in California, El Cerrito is Alameda County, correct?
Yes.
So I believe Alameda County is using optical scan machines, and in that case, you actually fill out a paper ballot yourself. The voter fills it out,
right?
And then you walk it over to a poll worker who puts it into an optical scan machine. But you don't actually get the ballots after that. You don't walk away with the ballot. There are other devices that are sometimes used. They're called ballot marking devices, and in this case, it uses a touchscreen interface. So the voter makes their selection on a computer screen, and then that system actually prints out a paper ballot, and this may be what she's talking about. prints out the ballot, and you can look at it and make sure that it printed out your correct choices, and then you hand it to a poll worker, and they scan it into a machine. But again, the voter only temporarily gets to hold that paper and view it before surrendering it to the optical scan machine.
Okay, and I was just told, my mistake, El Cerrito is in Contra Costa County, not Alameda County.
Okay. So I believe what she may be talking about is a ballot marking device. If she's given a piece of paper, that may be what's happening here.
Right.
But still, she doesn't walk away with paper. It gets scanned through an optical scan machine. And I would say with that, so the issue here with optical scan machines, even though you have that paper ballot, you have that paper backup, states have to be looking at that. They have to be doing a manual audit and comparing a statistically significant sample of those paper ballots against the digital count. California does have a mandatory 1% audit, but it has until recently involved simply taking a random sampling of precincts, of 1% of precincts. So you would choose maybe a precinct here, a precinct there, a precinct there, and you take a random sampling of ballots from those precincts and you do a manual assessment of them. The problem with that is because it's not countywide, you could be auditing ballots at a precinct where no problems occurred, and all of the precincts where problems did occur then go completely unnoticed in that audit.
Thank you for the call, Ruth Ann. We'll get to your question about media coverage in a minute, but we have a related question from Joe, who says, it's often occurred to me that each time I vote, I receive a receipt with my ballot number on it. Why can't I just look online to see how that number recorded? It would be anonymous and verifiable. Kim, what do you think about that?
So this has been suggested. I mean, just having that number, counties could post online and say, this number ballot is included in the tabulation. And the voter would think, okay, that means my votes got counted. But that doesn't necessarily mean your votes got counted. All it means is that that particular ballot with that particular number was included in the ballots that got tabulated. It doesn't mean that the machine actually tabulated the votes on that ballot correctly.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Joe. Is there an idea that you have heard out there, Kim, that you think would work so people feel like they can double check and make sure that their vote was actually counted? Because the way that we vote here in San Francisco is we have a black marker, we pick our choices, there's usually four large pieces of paper because we have so many things to vote on, and then we stick it in a machine and it says you're voter number 512, and then you get a little receipt like the bottom of one of your ballots, and that's it.
So for about a decade, there has been a solution that has been bandied about. It involves what are known as cryptographic hashes. A cryptographic hash is basically a number that represents data. It involves running data through an algorithm to produce a long number, and that number represents the data on that ballot. If the data changes at all, the cryptographic hash won't match. So the solution that was suggested was that the ballot data, the votes that you cast on a ballot, would be cryptographically hashed. You would be given that hash to take home with you. And at the end of the election, election officials would then post all of the hashes that had been used in the tabulation of the tally. And you would be able to look and see your hash among them, and that hash would indicate that the data hadn't changed from what you initially voted. The problem with that is that people don't understand cryptographic hashes. It may be too sophisticated for voters to understand. It's not clear that voters would actually check the votes, the ballots afterwards, so it would be a lot of effort for no particular reason. The simplest solution that we have right now is paper ballots, optical scan machines, and what's called a risk-limiting audit, which takes a significant sample of ballots from every precinct after an election. And that would help us catch software glitches. It would help us catch hack software. It would help us catch a lot of things. And simply, it's not being done.
All right. Well, thank you, Joe. We have time for one more question. Let's go to Ray in San Francisco. Hi, Ray.
Yes. Hi. I think I heard the author say the same thing that Congresswoman Jackie Speier said, and I read in two newsletters that there has not been an audit of any of the vote totals to see if any of those were reconfigured? And if that's true, why hasn't there been?
Are we talking about 2016 specifically?
Well, any of them. They like Jackie Spears said that no one has ever really looked.
Right. So it's the problem that I mentioned, that states that do audits don't do them don't do sufficient audits that would actually be designed to catch anything, and that's a problem with the lawmakers who design the law. They create a lot of loopholes in it that looks like it's producing a viable audit that will tell us if an election has integrity, but in practice, it's the audits are not being conducted in the manner that would do that. So it's sort of ignorance about really auditing mechanisms. And that's starting to change because Colorado is the first state so far that's done what's called a risk-limiting audit. They pilot tested it last year, and the concept of that is now starting to spread among states. It'll take a while for states to actually implement those, but if we can get them, all of the states to implement risk-limiting audits with paper ballots, that will be our best hope of having elections that have integrity.
Go ahead, Kim.
Sorry. Well, I was just going to answer sort of the other half of his question in terms of no one looking. The other thing that you can do, of course, is to look at the software on the voting machines to see if it is altered. And again, we have the problem that you mentioned with John Kerry, is that the voting machine vendors don't allow people to look at the software after an election. The software in many states is escrowed, meaning that the state has the software in a repository, and it could potentially look at that software. They simply don't. And I should also qualify that with the fact that even if you look at software to see if it's changed, there's no guarantee that you actually see changes, because a really sophisticated hacker is going to erase any evidence of their tracks after.
Wow. Well, Kim, thank you so much for all the work you do, and we'd love to have you back, and we'll find out what happens on Tuesday with all of these machines, and we'll see how many problems there are across the country. Thanks for your work, Kim.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you. Kim Zetter is an award-winning investigative journalist. Find her piece, The Crisis of Election Security, at yourcallradio.org. There's also a number of other lengthy good pieces. Scientific American, The New Yorker, has problems out about voting machine errors, and you can find those online. Joining us now is Will Carless, a correspondent for Reveal, who covers extremism and has worked as a foreign correspondent in Asia and South America. Hi, Will. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Will. It has been almost a week since Jair Bolsonaro was elected president in Brazil. He got 55% of the vote. And one protester told The Guardian, quote, "What we are most feeling is fear, fear of what might happen, fear of what all of this might generate," end quote. So, Will, give us a sense of the mood. What is it like in the aftermath of this election?
I think it depends very much where you are, what neighborhood you're in, who your neighbors are, who your friends are, who your groups are. And I say that because this is a country that's very, very split right now. You've got, you've got a lot of people who are extremely upset and despondent and depressed about Jair Bolsonaro. But you've also got people like the, admittedly rather nice high-end neighborhood that I live in, who are absolutely ecstatic about this man and very pleased to have seen the back of the People's Party, who have basically run Brazil since 2002. So it really depends where you are and who your group of friends are, but ranging from totally despondent to ecstatic.
I'm sure a lot of people have heard some of the sexist things, the racist things that he has said. You know, he's described as a pro-military dictator, misogynist, anti-gay, pro-torture. For those who haven't been following this very closely, can you just give us a thumbnail sketch? Who is Jair Bolsonaro?
Well, that was you did a pretty good job right there. But I mean, basically, this is a guy who's a career politician. He's been a congressman for many, many years. Never really accomplished much in Congress, it has to be said. He's most famous for his outbursts, for his sort of hateful, misogynistic, awful things that he's said. He's most famous for telling a congresswoman on the floor of Brazil's Congress that she, quote, wasn't worth raping, essentially because she wasn't, pretty enough for him. He's also said things like, on a TV show, he said that he would rather that one of his sons was killed in an accident than came out of the closet and was gay. He has, you know, said some pretty vile things, not only about women and the LGBT community, but also some pretty sketchy things, not quite as blatant, but some pretty awful things about Afro-Brazilians too. So, you know, this is the guy who's most famous for his outbursts and never really done much else up until last week.
What about media coverage of Bolsonaro and the race overall? What was that like?
Well, it's been such a strange election because, you know, you had the PT, the People's Party, who are the left-wing party, who, as I say, you know, the last four elections have all gone to the PT. They had put forward former president Luis Inácio da Silva, who goes by Lula. Unfortunately, halfway through the sort of election cycle, Lula was found guilty of money laundering and corruption and was put in jail. And there was right up until a few months before the election, there was a lot of confusion about whether Lula would still be allowed to run. And he was the People's Party candidate until about, I think it's 2 months before the election. There was then a court decision that said no. In fact, he can't run, and in fact, isn't allowed to advertise and that sort of thing. And the People's Party switched out their candidate for a guy called Fernando Haddad, who was the mayor of São Paulo, but again was like really unknown. So a lot of the media coverage was just bringing people up to speed with who these people are, who these people that you don't really know very much about are, you know, a lot of backgrounding, that sort of thing. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, right leading up in the days before the election, this was still just became a very polarized race between you're either standing for the status quo, for a left-wing future for Brazil, or you're going to go take a punt on a very right-wing guy in Jair Bolsonaro. And that's where we ended up with a very sort of nasty split race in the days before the election.
What was voter turnout?
So in Brazil, voting is compulsory. So voter turnout was extremely high, but it always is. Because if you don't vote, you actually get a small fine, but it can also lead to various different problems. For example, it's hard to get a passport if you haven't voted. So the voter turnout was very high. Having said that, about 31 million Brazilians, so I believe that's about a quarter to a third of the electorate, cast a null vote. They wouldn't vote for either one of the candidates. So that tells you just how much of a difficult choice this was for a lot of people. It was either, you know, status quo with a party that has kind of, I think it's fair to say, run Brazil pretty much into the ground in the last couple of years with its, you know, terrible economy and corruption scandals, or a guy who's got this sort of awful, vile, hateful past. And I think the result was, you know, the result clearly was that 30, more than 30 million people just couldn't in good faith cast a vote for either one of those candidates.
Wow, that's a huge number. Today we're speaking with Will Carlos, correspondent for Reveal. He's worked as a foreign correspondent in Asia and South America. And today we are talking about media coverage of the election of Jair Bolsonaro, who will be Brazil's new president, described as a pro-military dictator, misogynist, anti-gay, pro-torture. If you have any questions for Will, we'd love to hear from you. This is getting a lot of media attention. What do you think of that attention, especially in Western and in U.S. outlets? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. As you said, Will, of course, it depends on who you talk to about the election. Can you give us a sense, though, of, you know, what is life like for Brazilians, especially, well, let's first talk about indigenous Brazilians, because we're hearing a lot about the Amazon rainforest and what he's planning to do, how it'll affect the environment. But talk about indigenous Brazilians. What role did they play in this election?
They didn't play a huge role in this election other than sort of being a very divisive issue. So Jair Bolsonaro has pledged to open up indigenous lands to mining and to greater exploitation. He's basically going to, you know, severely limit indigenous rights in this country. And it should be said that this is, you know, racism and white supremacy is a strange beast in Brazil. This is a country that's sort of split down the middle, where you have about half of Brazilians who identify as white and about half of Brazilians who identify as either black or brown. So sort of the blatant kind of white supremacy racism that we've seen, particularly in the United States, and I think ramping up in the United States over the past few weeks, doesn't really catch on in Brazil. But what happens is you have this sort of quasi-racism that takes place in terms of, you know, fighting against indigenous rights, in terms of campaigning and bringing up policies that will get rid of policies aimed to increase the number of Afro-Brazilians going to school, you know, going to university, affirmative action. And so that's the sort of dog whistling that Jair Bolsonaro is doing. He's not come out and sort of, you know, talked in I would say even as sort of extremist terms as Donald Trump, but it's very clear where he stands when it comes to minority groups like the indigenous population in Brazil.
Well, it's pretty brutal. Fiona Watson has a piece in The Guardian, and she writes, the country's 900,000 strong indigenous people are among the many minority groups Bolsonaro has targeted with vitriolic hostility. He once said, quote, it's a shame that the Brazilian cavalry wasn't as efficient as the Americans who exterminated their Indians, end quote. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't exterminate every Indian, but they exterminated most. She also writes that there are around 100 uncontacted tribes in Brazil, more than anywhere else on Earth, and all are in peril unless their land is protected. And Bolsonaro has threatened to close down FUNAI, the government's Indigenous Affairs Department, which is charged with protecting indigenous land. How significant is this, and do you think that he's going to go through with this?
It's very hard to tell what, you know, it's very hard to separate bluster from, you know, what he actually plans to do. I mean, this is a guy, as I say, I mean, he basically made his political name by being as outrageous as possible. So now that he has power, it's going to be very, you know, interesting. We're going to have to watch very carefully how much of that bluster, you know, turns into reality. It should be said that he did come to power with not only a very strong remit from the Brazilian people, but also brought a lot of Congress people with him, a lot of federal lawmakers with him. You know, I've had friends comment to me, you know, in recent days, well, you know, Bolsonaro is a fascist, but at least he's just one guy. And, you know, the response to that is no, not really. I mean, anybody who rode Jair Bolsonaro's coattails into Congress, including, you know, a number of people who really no one had heard of up until a couple of weeks before the election, were able to win election as Congress people, as governors, as, you know, as even municipal politicians, all with this sort of extreme right-wing rhetoric. You know, this guy has a big team supporting him. He's got a big number of people who are on his side and are going to help him bring forwards whatever policy he wants. So, yeah, it's scary times for the indigenous, it's scary times for Afro-Brazilians, it's scary times for the LGBTQ community here too. I think all of those groups need to be on high alert.
Mm. What are you hearing from poor Brazilians, people who struggle to make ends meet? What are you hearing from them?
Well, you see, I live in Rio de Janeiro, which is Jair Bolsonaro's hometown, and it's also a city that's always had pretty bad crime, but is right now is in pretty much chaos in terms of security. The army has been patrolling the favelas, certain favelas in Rio de Janeiro, for several months. You know, the homicides are absolutely through the roof. There's a real problem with the security situation here, and I say that to give context to the next point, which is that when you talk to a lot of poor Brazilians, a lot of even Afro-Brazilians, poorer people who live in these communities and favelas, there a lot of them support Jair Bolsonaro because he has come out and said that he's going to, you know, really tackle crime. He's going to really make security a big focus of what he's doing, and that resonates. You know, that resonates with people who have seen their communities, you know, racked by crime over the last, you know, forever, but specifically increasingly over the last few years. So The example I go back to is there's a guy who collects chairs on the beach right by my house in front of a hotel. And I remember having a conversation with him a couple of weeks ago, just chatting to him and saying, hey, who are you supporting? He said, oh, Bolsonaro, absolutely. And I said, how? I mean, why? Why are you supporting this guy? He's clearly a guy who represents, you know, Brazil's elites. What do you think he's going to do for you? And he's like, look, I live in a favela. I'm scared every time I walk through the favela at night. I hear gunshots all the time, and I'm hoping that this guy is going to come in and is going to do what he says, and he's going to make my life, you know, safer and better for my family and for my kids. So you hear that an awful lot, at least in the city that I live in.
In our remaining minute, Will, what about policies? He's planning to privatize state-owned industries, pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. Like Trump, he wants to move the embassy from, let's see, he's going to move the embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, right? Mm-hmm. What else is on his list?
Well, the first of those two things are not clear. They fall into the category of, you know, is this bluster? Is he really going to do it? You know, so he is moving the embassy. That's true. But for example, he very controversially merged two government ministries. I believe it's the environmental ministry was combined with, I'm blanking on what the other ministry was. Now, he announced that, and 24 hours later, he actually reversed course on that. So I think a lot of these things fall into the category of, you know, is it bluster or is he really going to do it? And I think we're not going to know just how extreme he is until he starts to really push these things forward.
And what is his reasoning for moving the embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
I mean, it's a populist move, right? I mean, it's. I've never, frankly, quite understood the politics behind that. I'm not, you know, that boned up on the Middle East, but you know, Donald Trump did it, so Jair Bolsonaro is going to do it. And I don't like so much the comparisons between Donald Trump and Bolsonaro, because I think that they're a bit simplistic. But Bolsonaro wanted a quick hit, easy policy win, and that was an obvious one, and it appealed to his base, and that's what he went for. So that politics.
And final question, Will, what about the left in Brazil? How are they responding? How strong is the left right now?
The left is reeling. I mean, much as the Democratic Party was in the wake of November 2016, the left is absolutely reeling here. You know, they need new focus. They need a new leader. I think that they relied too much on Lula, on the former president, and hoping that he would come back. As soon as he wasn't allowed on the ballot, they kind of fell apart. So I think that the left's going to be looking for new leaders in the years to come. They still have a lot of support. It's whether they can, you know, rally and come back in 4 years or not.
Well, Will, thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Will Carlos is a correspondent for Reveal, and he has worked as a foreign correspondent in Asia and South America. And you can find his reporting and more coverage on Brazil, especially this very important piece about how the indigenous community and indigenous tribes will be affected by Bolsonaro's election at yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can leave us a review. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and David Latulip, who is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.